uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border on radio stations from California to North Carolina, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, American FM on live365.com, our chat room at tomhartman.com if you want to drop in and say hi. Click chat room, and then when you get to the message board, click chat room again. It'll take you to it. And if you'd like to call into the program, our toll-free number all across the United States, and I believe Canada as well, 1-866-889-8894. So much on our plate today. China is doing the job W should do. We'll get to that. We have a Berlusconi alert for you. We have a delay alert. At the top of the next hour, we're going to have on the head of rightmarch.com, one of these right-wing groups who is talking about the vast left-wing conspiracy to get Tom DeLay. And we're going to find out from him all about us, I guess. You know, here we are. You're in the middle of it. But first, we have a new pope, Benedict the 16th. And I keep wanting to say Benedictine, and partly because I used to drink that stuff from time to time, I guess. But anyhow, we have a new pope, and I wanted to get the perspective of somebody within the Catholic Church. I'm Christian, but I'm Protestant, and I have a passing familiarity with Catholicism, and certainly a historical familiarity with it, or with the history of it, but not an inside view. So Joe Nagel is a priest with the Franciscan Missionary Service. He spent 15 years in South America, and he's with us. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Well, hi, Tom. Good morning.
Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's good to be with you.
Give us your take on the track record of Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict the 16th.
That's right. I liked your comment about Benedictine. I thought the same thing. Maybe we should sit down and have a Benedictine. Track record.
Was Benedict, by the way, before we get to the Pope,
yeah.
Just you can help me most likely with some of this historical stuff. Was Benedict the first, the founder of the Benedictine order?
No, he wasn't. And I'm glad to be able to answer that, not because it's so important, but if you had asked me about any other Benedict, I probably wouldn't have been able to tell you anything. He was not, and I don't know who he was, but there was a Saint Benedict who started the Benedictine order way back in the 500s. He was not a pope.
He was not a pope. Okay.
No, he wasn't. Great. The last Benedict was number 15, and that was during the First World War, which gives some clue as to what this new pope might be about. He was very concerned about Europe. This Benedict the 15th in the First World War offered himself as a mediator between the then Axis powers and the Allies, and they both refused him. He wanted to see if he could stop that awful conflict, and they said that the war killed him. So he was a European and very much involved in Europe, which may give a clue to.
So do you think that this Pope Benedict may see himself, or the Church may see him, as somebody who may, on the one hand, play the role of intermediary or preventer of war, or on the other hand, as somebody who, I wouldn't say facilitates a war, but is the right guy to be in the job if the world is about to go into war, let's say?
Well, he was much against the Iraq War, our adventurism in Iraq.
Pope John Paul II.
As he was, that's right. And they were together on that one. I'm not sure about, should a war come about, but I'm thinking more that this pope gives a clue with his name to his interest in Europe and the fact that Europe has gone so secular from his point of view. That's what everybody's saying anyway. So
yeah.
Who knows? We'll see.
So his track record,
track record
of Pope Benedict the 16th here,
16th,
what is his personal track record?
Well, huge intellect, people say. He's been in academia all his life. And then for the last 26 years, which is a long time, he's been the official custodian, if you will, or watch person for orthodoxy in the Catholic Church. So that's
Now, isn't that the office that used to be called the Inquisition?
Well, it was way back, the Office of the Inquisition. More recently, it was called the Holy Office, and now, more recently, it's called the Office for the Doctrine of the Faith. So it's sort of had a kind of an evolution.
But,
yeah.
But this is the guy who was the head of the office that was once the Inquisition.
That
gives me chills.
Well, it does. And, of course, I don't know if we're doing Inquisitions anymore, but there was a lot of concern about this cardinal becoming pope, because he was pretty tough on some of the theologians who, you know, emerged since the Second Vatican Council. So he's got a track record of being a pretty hardliner on theological matters.
Well, now, he also interfered in the U.S. election. He wrote a letter to U.S. bishops, which said essentially that any politician who was running for office who was Catholic and who was taking as a political point of view that abortion should remain safe and legal, should not be given communion, and that anyone who voted for such a politician who was Catholic was doomed.
Well, I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration. What he said was that if a politician were to vote in favor of abortion because of abortion, if a citizen voted for a politician who was pro-choice. Because he was pro-choice, that would be not acceptable. But he did say in that same letter that if you vote for a politician who is pro-choice for other considerations, which, by the way, I did, then those considerations should be taken into consideration.
Oh, interesting. Because the story I have here off, it's AFP, Agence France-Presse.
Yeah.
It says, in the June 2004 letter to U.S. bishops enunciating principles of worthiness for communion recipients, Ratzinger specified that strong and open supporters of abortion should be denied the Catholic sacrament for being guilty of a grave sin. He specifically mentioned, quote, the case of a Catholic politician consistently campaigning and voting for permissive abortion and euthanasia laws, end quote, a reference widely understood to mean Democratic candidate John Kerry.
And the letter
went on to say, any priest confronted with such a person seeking communion, quote, must refuse to distribute it, end quote.
Yeah. That's an interpretation, I think, of what, because the entire letter was, I think, and in fact I use it in some of my talks about what we consider a consistent ethic of life, that life is precious from before birth until death, and that all of those steps in between birth and death need to be considered.
Which the Republican Party tends to ignore.
Well, I think so. But anyway.
So does Ratzinger ignore them? Is he one who would say, okay, let's get real, real whipped up here about abortion and euthanasia, and but, you know, please don't bother me with the fact that there's homeless people and there's hungry people and there's AIDS in Africa and, well, all over the world, and we just don't want to get into that stuff.
I can't believe that he would be in that kind of a position, Tom, really. I think that he may have a certain sort of emphasis on some of the, if you will, hot button issues. But the Catholic social teaching, which he has to subscribe to, is very, very consistent in terms of all of the life issues.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd have to be a part of that. Now, it remains to be seen, I think, how much he's going to be outspoken regarding situations of poverty around the world, and that's my big problem.
This was a big issue. We're speaking with Joe Nagel, by the way. Joe is a priest with the Franciscan Missionary Service. Worked 15 years in South America. Saw poverty up front and personal. I've worked in South America as well, doing social work and relief work, and have seen it. We started a program in the slums of Bogota, in the La Paz slum. The program in Peru, in Quito, Ecuador. We run a program down there. So, you know, we have both, I suspect, seen this probably from slightly different viewpoints, but not, you know.
Really.
And is this going to be, do you think, a big issue for him?
Well, I hope so. There's nothing in the track record, as you put it, that gives us any kind of clues that way. I don't think I've ever heard anything from him about poverty. Of course, there was plenty from John Paul, so maybe that was enough. You know, he kept telling us that Lazarus, the old Lazarus story from the Gospel, is at our gate, and we America's gate, and we need to pay attention to Lazarus. That would be what I would expect from the new pope, that line right there.
To speak to America. You know, that is so underreported. I don't think the average American has any idea that the policies of the Bush administration And even back the policies of the Reagan administration, the previous Bush, and some of the policies of the Clinton administration, for that matter, mm-hmm. that there have been specific criticisms of American policies by the Holy See, by the Pope, and by the Vatican.
Very much. I saw John Paul personally in 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, and we were pleading with him to come to the United Nations and speak more clearly, if you will, or more visibly about his opposition to that war. Of course, he couldn't come. He was in bad shape even then. And he did send a cardinal, though, to talk to Bush personally about the impending war. And so we felt that was the result of our visit to Rome.
But, right, but that story appeared on, like, page 9 of the few papers that carried
exactly.
it. It was,
exactly.
And Bush came out with some glib remark, you know, like, oh, well, we had a good conversation or something.
Yeah. Well, you'd expect the Pope to be against war. I guess that's what I heard here, yeah.
Well, there have been popes who have not been against wars. I mean...
Well, yeah, that's true. Historically,
talk
that's
about
true.
The Crusades.
Yeah, Crusades. We've had popes leading armies. That's true. But
yeah.
I think we've got conversion in there a little bit since then.
Well, you've had popes leading armies right up till the 1870s.
Well,
yeah, that's when Italy took back their territory, or what
yeah.
you know, from the Italian point of view, and
yeah.
and took on whoever was pope then.
Yeah, yeah, they did.
Yeah. So how do you see? I've read some newspaper stories, some op-ed pieces that suggest that really what's going on is that this guy's like a placeholder. And then I've read others that say, no, he's really there to clean things up, that there have been these, you know, sexual abuse scandals and whatnot. The church has been in disarray. There's been a lot of dissent. There's this liberal element out there in the church that is arguing for social justice and at the far ends of that, even things like gay rights and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And that his job is really to clean all that up, to be the hard hand and take the heat and do, you know, just clamp down on things. And then, you know, others who say, well, maybe there was no specific intention. He was the most powerful guy. And John Paul positioned him, essentially, because he picked so many of the cardinals who would vote on him. What's your take on that?
Well, I think the latter. I think that he was very visible around the time of John Paul's death. He had the funeral and he had everything. You know, he was the senior prelate. My guess would be that at his age, they felt that the other cardinals felt that he would continue John Paul's major thrust, but that it would not be a long pontificate. That he will, you know, pass from the scene within a relatively short time, and then maybe there will be a shift in, if you will, in some kind of policy. Who knows what they were thinking?
Right.
But he is 78, and he, I think, and another element is that he is now the Pope, and he's not the guardian of orthodoxy as he was. You know, he's now the shepherd, if you will, or the pastor of the whole crowd of us.
Yeah. Well, Joe Nagel, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you.
I do appreciate it. Joe Nagel, a priest with the Franciscan Missionary Service. And great work you're doing, Joe. Keep it up. Thank you so much for being with us. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brusho, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Oh, do we need Harry Truman? Somebody who will say the buck stops here. And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes after, here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, the no boring zone. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Freeman in San Diego is on the line. Hey, Freeman, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. You know how they have must-see TV?
Yes.
This is like must-hear radio for me. This
thank you.
The only program that I really love listening to, and I make a point every day.
Well, thank you.
So.
That
anyway,
kind of feedback keeps me going. I appreciate it. I really, truly do.
You
so what's on your mind?
So I only call when I disagree with you. And As a former Republican-leaning person, the one thing that I think most Republicans don't like to hear is like the bleeding heart liberal, oh, this poor person. I think you do a really good job of saying why it's in our best interest to help, you know, quote-unquote, that poor person. And one thing you said yesterday really kind of caught my attention is when you were talking about you requiring ID to vote, and then you kind of went into saying, well, maybe we should just have literacy tests and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that was kind of along those lines of, oh, poor me. And I don't think it's that much to expect, you know, someone have an ID card. You don't need a driver's license, but, you know, at least in California, you can get an ID card and not a driver's license. And, of course, it's only $30. And I don't think that's too much to expect for voting.
I think it is. I really do think it is. You're going to ask a lot of people. You're going to be asking a lot of people who live in urban areas and they don't have driver's licenses. You're going to be asking a lot of elderly people who find it very difficult to get out. I mean, voting is a major effort for them. Mm-hmm. To go to the DMV and stand in line for, in some cases, 5, 6, 7 hours, depending on where they live, in order to get a photo ID in the same line where you get driver's licenses. And to be able to vote. And, you know, why?
Maybe.
And they're not going to present a photo ID to get that photo ID.
Right. Do you think that maybe just requiring them to show some sort of ID, you know, maybe just if they had like a credit card and a
PG&E
bill, you know.
Yeah, I have no problem with some evidence of who you are. I have no problem with that. But the Republicans are hanging, exclusively the Republicans, are hanging their hat on this thing of it's got to be a government-issued photo ID, because they say the reason why is because they say, well, there's all these illegal aliens, and they are actually trying to swing our elections. Now, in which direction, I'm not sure. It seems to me like George W. Bush is the one who wants to make it, you know, make life nice here for illegal aliens. So, you know, that in that context, their argument doesn't make any sense. But that's the boogeyman that they pull out of their pocket. And really what they're trying to do is disenfranchise urban people, poor people, and old people, because those people tend to vote overwhelmingly Democratic.
Do you know if there's any study done by, you know, of how many people that vote Democratic versus, you know, how many people would be, I don't know, it would be difficult for them to get some sort of photo ID?
I don't know. I can tell you, for example, my mother, who is in her late 70s, she hasn't had a driver's license in 30 years. She doesn't have any photo ID.
How does she, you know, go to the bank?
My father drives her around. So how's she supposed to vote?
I would think that she would have some sort of photo ID if she wanted to use a credit card.
She doesn't. She really doesn't. She's one of those old school women who got married, settled down. She was the mother to four boys, and that's what she did with her life. And she never got a driver's license. We were not, you know, the upper middle class. We weren't a two car family. We were a one car family. Dad did all the driving, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And that's not unusual in that generation.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, you know, I only live in my own little circle, but
although my mother's a Republican, so.
Yeah, I know, you mentioned that before.
Maybe they shouldn't. No, I don't want to say that. Right, I just don't want to say that. This is a partisan issue. This is just very clearly a partisan issue. I can't cite you any particular study, but I know that they're out there. The Republicans know they're out there. The Democrats know they're out there. Everybody knows what's really going on here. And that's really the issue with regard to this, is who's going to vote, not who's legally going to vote, but who's going to vote, if you know what I mean. This is not about stopping people from illegally voting. There's not a huge criminal element out there that's just itching to vote for Bush or Kerry kind of thing. You know, they by and large tend not to care.
That's
Freeman,
right,
thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 29 minutes after the hour, the Tom Hartman Program.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, we eliminate the middleman? Well, one thing's pretty certain. It wasn't the...
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends.
Someone told me long ago.
Look out for Republicans, that's what they told me. Ever since Reagan was elected, that's the bottom line. I'm telling you, it is here. This is the calm before the storm. 17% drop in housing starts last month. Totally unexpected. They were expecting maybe a 4% drop. Big story in the Wall Street Journal today. Housing prices starting to go south. The economy beginning to show the effects of 25 years, more or less, of conservative economic policies. It is coming home to roost, my friends. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to be on the program. Bob in Indiana, a trucker on the road. Hey, Bob.
How you doing, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I thought I'd pass on something to you I think you'd get a little kick out of, talking about this photo ID thing, which I'm completely on your side on. I think it's absolutely ludicrous. But I was born and raised in the state of West Virginia. And when you go into the state of West Virginia to renew your driver's license, you have to have three pieces of identification.
Right.
One of which cannot be your driver's license.
Oh, interesting. So you can't use a driver's license to renew a driver's license?
That's right. You cannot renew your license.
Is this something new, Bob?
Oh, no. It's been going on for years.
Huh.
And you cannot use a West Virginia-issued photo driver's license to renew your West Virginia driver's license.
Now, you're not talking about commercial licenses only. You're talking about all driver's licenses.
All driver's licenses.
Interesting. Why?
Don't ask me.
Yeah.
I've asked them and never gotten an answer when I was still living in the state, but they'll accept Social Security number, mail to your address, credit card, anything like that.
Yeah.
But they will not accept your photo-issued driver's license from the state of West Virginia.
So what the conservatives want you to use to vote with for ID, the state of West Virginia will not accept as ID to give you a driver's license.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a little ironic, isn't it? That's great.
I thought you might appreciate that.
I do. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. That's a good one.
Thank you.
Have a great day, and keep on listening, keep on trucking. Jim in Pittsburgh on the line. Hey,
yes,
Jim.
Sir. Thank you, Tom. Boy, I'll tell you what. We've got a situation going here that it really scares me.
Here in Pennsylvania, here in Pittsburgh, here in the United States?
Pennsylvania, yes, okay. Sir. They have what they call row offices here in the county, office. And there's 10 of them. And what they're doing now, it's not the chief executive that's in there so much as the people behind there pushing this. They want to take the row office, and they're calling a consolidation of row office.
Hang on just a second here, Jim. I don't know what a row office is.
Okay, that's like the patentary recorder deeds and all those things. They're elected by the people.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So their cap is set by the state law at $64,000.
Their salary cap.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
The last time they appointed someone, the man made $129,000 to replace the man that they, got out of there.
Yeah.
So what they're asking the people do to vote on a referendum to give up their right to vote for these elected officers, they said we're going to save $773,000.
By not holding elections.
Right.
Oh,
right.
Wait
a minute. Let me tell you what happened.
But it's worse?
Wait, let me tell you what happened with the last appointee.
Okay.
The county commissioners, we had a county commissioner government at that time. They appointed a man to what they called a regional asset board,
right,
where they collected taxes. This man would not vote to give this football and baseball teams $13 million a year.
So they got rid of him.
So they got rid of him. The man that came in voted. He was the vote to push it over top, gave him $26 million for 30 years, gave the naming rights to our stadium to the owner of the football team for $30 million, and we're left holding the bag with that. Now,
right.
What they're doing, they're taking our vote, constitutional right to vote, away from us to give it to some fogey who they'll probably have. And the football team owners had a fundraiser for the county commissioner who did that and raised $250,000. But we voted him out of office. The next man to come in was the county executive. We went to a different form. He appointed the assessment board.
I got it, Jim.
Okay, wait a minute.
We got a lot of listeners outside of Pittsburgh. I don't want to get into too much detail here.
One thing I want to say.
Okay.
Two worst people ever lived on this face earth in my 73 years gave the people a right to vote. One, Adolf Hitler. There was no candidate running against him. The other was Saddam Hussein. One man voted against him. He killed his brother.
Yeah.
And they had the right to vote, and we're getting our right to vote to taken away.
Yeah. Well, it's just consistent, absolutely consistent, Jim, with the Republican way.
Well, I hope the people learn. If you can vote for anyone, never give that right up. We had it for 250 some years. never give it up.
There you go.
Thank
well
you,
said.
Sir.
You're welcome, Jim. Thanks for the call and thanks for making that statement. And I have to say, you know, this is just an extension of the Republican logic of 2001. What? The people vote? You know, when George W. Bush sued the Gore campaign in Bush v. Gore before the Supreme Court to stop the count in Florida, the count that would have showed, if the entire state was recounted, that Al Gore won the election of 2000. When George W. Bush sued in the Supreme Court to stop that recount, his logic was, the Constitution says that you have the right to vote for your member of the House of Representatives. It's in the 14th Amendment. It's the second or third paragraph of the 14th Amendment or article or whatever. But the Constitution does not say you have the right to vote for president. Instead, the Constitution explicitly says that the Electoral College elects the president, and the electors, the members of the Electoral College, are determined by the states in whatever manner the states choose. The states can choose to have the electors picked by we the people, by voting, or the states can choose to simply say, hey, we're the state legislature, and we're going to decide who the electors for our state are going to be. And in fact, that's exactly what Tom Feeney said he was going to do when he was the Speaker of the House in the state of Florida, and during 2000, when all this mess was going on, and Jim Baker was down there trying to hijack, well, not trying to, successfully, down there hijacking an election in Florida, and Tom Feeney comes out and says, you know, even if the recount shows that Al Gore won Florida, we're still going to send Republican electors to Washington, D.C. for the Electoral College. So don't even bother, guys. And it was like it was a small story for a half a day. It's the Republican way. Voters? Voters? We don't need no stinking voters. Will of the voters? Don't give me this nonsense. Joe in Brookings, Oregon on the line. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Electoral College is a crock anyway, so we should have got rid of it a long time ago.
Yeah, well, there's arguments for and against it, and I can lay them both out, but I do believe that it would be better for us to have direct election of the president.
Yes. I called up about the Pope, and everything I've heard about this guy, there's nothing to like about this guy. And you said something about, maybe they put this guy in, try clean everything up, like with the sex abuse scandal and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
Well, what I heard this guy, what he had to say about the sex abuse scandal is that he thought the whole thing was exaggerated by the media.
Hmm.
And that it wasn't really that big a deal.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, what a creep.
Well, I can't back that up. I don't know if he said that or not, and I would be very reluctant.
Yeah. Like anybody else, I saw that on the news yesterday. Yeah. And then the other terrible thing about him is the terrible thing that's been about the Catholic Church, for the last few, I don't know what, years, decades. You know, down in Latin America, you have this terrible problem with overpopulation and misery,
yeah,
and poverty. But
they can't have birth control. I'll tell you, they can't have birth control, that, according to the church. And that's where you're going, right, Joe?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, yeah. I got to tell you.
The Catholic Church is a hugely responsible for the problem with illegal immigration, with all the misery you got in Latin America.
Oh, yes, and I will lay that at their feet. Joe, I appreciate your call. Absolutely. I was down in Bogota. We were down there working, and there was a woman from Germany who was running our program in Bogota for the Kinder- und Jugendhilfsversammlung, for this German international relief program that I was working with. And we went in to see the Archbishop of Bogota, the head Catholic official in Bogota. And they had offered us some land, and there's this whole long story. But anyhow, she says to him, why don't you just allow the pharmacists to sell contraceptive devices without fear of burning in hell forever? Just allow the pharmacists to do that. And he starts pounding his fist on the arm of his throne. He's sitting on a throne. He sits pounding his fist on this, pointing at me. He won't talk to her. Pointing at me, saying, it's women who are responsible for this. They know when they're fertile. They're the ones who are uncontrolled. It all started with Eve. And he's going into this whole long rant about women are the cause of all these. It was scary. I was trying to back out of that room. And this guy just blew up at me, in my face. And you're right. And there are many people within the Catholic Church, particularly the Catholic hierarchy, who that's where they're at. Ed in San Juan Capistrano on the line. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program.
Yeah, caller. Thank you, Tom. Hey, two things. I wasn't going to talk about the Catholic Church, but we went to a wedding a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
Nine, no less than nine times did the priest tell the couple to have children for the church.
Yeah, well, see, that's
nine times,
that's
Tom.
The strategy.
My wife and I were appalled. We just,
they are trying to outnumber the Muslims. They're
children
trying to,
for the church.
Children for the church, yeah.
But you got to have some fun with other things. You know,
by the way, the Mormons are doing the same thing. You know.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful thing. Have as many as you can have. You don't have to feed them. You don't have to clothe them. Just have them.
Yeah.
The church will take care of them. but you want to have fun with this ID card and stuff like this. Whenever you're asked for a picture ID,
right?
Do you have a Costco up there?
I don't know.
It's a club store.
Yeah, I know what Costco is. We just moved to Portland, and I'm not sure if there's one here or not.
Yeah, use your Costco ID card, your club card.
Is there? It's a photo ID card.
And they put a photo on it. I use it for college. I use it for the motor vehicle. That's all I ever do is plop down my Costco card, and it has worked every time.
And they accept
time.
It. That's great.
It every time across the board.
That's great.
And that's
great.
That's all I have to have. No driver's license, no nothing. Costco card.
I wonder if...
have fun with it, Tom.
I will. Thanks a lot, Ed. I appreciate the call. I wonder if you could use that to vote. I mean, that would be a hoot. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jeremy in State College, Pennsylvania on the line. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, Jeremy.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to get back to the voting thing. I don't know. I'm a younger fella, but my frustration is as follows. The representative in my district, in the 5th District here, is John Peterson. And basically...
Democrat or Republican?
He's Republican, and he votes against rural economic interests very heavily. He voted for the bankruptcy bill. He voted against the Obie Amendment way back when to, you know, change the overtime rules back.
Right.
But the point is, he has run unopposed by a Democrat or liberal candidate since 1996. And there is a very organized Center County Democratic Party, but they're very entrenched in the corporate DLC Democrats.
Right.
And they just don't want to run anybody.
Uh-huh.
So every 2 years, they just say it's not worth putting the financial efforts into a district they're going
to
lose.
Well, hey, it's time to get active in that district.
Yeah, I've started to a little bit.
Get in there. Get active. Bring some friends. Take it over.
Yeah, because, they're very entrenched. It's going to be hard to do. They're kind of a sacred cow. But anyway, I called his office, and I talked to his representative, and I said things like, you know, when's the last time he actually showed up to, like, the State College area to give a town hall meeting?
Right.
And he's like, well, he was just there last week giving a check to the Geisinger Hospital. I'm like, no. Not photo ops. I'm talking about a town hall meeting.
An actual, yeah.
To talk to issues. And that's why I really appreciate guys like Bernie Sanders who take the time to,
Bernie is hyperactive about these things. I mean, you say town hall meeting, and Bernie's like, where? I'll be there. It's just, and I've been to like three or four of them that he's done. And he stands up, and for an hour, he'll stay there until midnight if people are still wanting to talk to him. And he lets them berate him. He listens carefully. He will tell them truthfully. When he disagrees with them, he doesn't try to weasel out of it. It's why I have him on every Friday. He's, as far as I know, one of the few honest politicians out there.
Yeah, and I'm just glad that people like that still do that, because even Arlen Specter, he comes to State College on a pretty regular basis, once every year or two, to come and have a town hall meeting. And even if you disagree with them for the most part, I mean, between Santorum and Specter, I'll take Specter, but at least he comes and talks to the public on issues. And my representative in the 5th District just doesn't bother because he's never challenged.
Yeah, well, it's time to challenge him. Jeremy, I got to move along, but I appreciate you making the call, and thanks for bringing up the issue. And, yes, it is time to start challenging these people more and more and more. Nancy, a trucker going through Missouri on the line. Hey, Nancy.
Hi.
What's up?
I wanted to comment on the Catholic Church and the birth control thing.
Yes, and the Archbishop who yelled at me.
Yeah.
Boy, did he. He preached a sermon right in my face, I'll tell you.
Hey, aren't you the lucky one?
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
Well, actually, they're covering two areas here. Okay, they're getting more kids for the church, you know, no birth control, have a lot of kids for the church, and they're disempowering women. If women are home having kids every year,
and there's a relationship between the two. You know, if you look at countries around the world, those countries that have the highest population growth rates are the countries that have where women have the least amount of power socially, culturally, and politically, and the lowest educational literacy rate. And in those countries with the lowest population rate or even negative population growth, as in some of the European countries and the Scandinavian countries, negative population growth, women have the highest level of social status, power, and literacy. There's a direct relationship. If you want to reduce population, empower women. It's that simple.
Yeah, I read that in one of your books.
Last Hours of Ancient Sun.
Well, and you look at the Catholic Church, they don't want women to do anything. You can't get married to one of them. You can't, if you're a priest, and you, a woman can't be a priest. I think they're really afraid of women.
Well, it could be, or it could just be that this is a system that worked well thousands of years ago when the imperative for the survival of a religion was that it grow and that there be, that you have children for the church. I mean, there was a time when it was small and there was lots of competing religions when sociologically you could say that that kind of a policy actually kind of made sense. But now there's a billion Catholics on the planet. We don't need any more. I mean, not to say that they shouldn't reproduce, but I mean, there's 6 billion humans on the planet. We don't need any more. Really, that's the bottom line. Nancy, thanks so much for the call. I appreciate hearing from you. We've got to move along here. That music telling us that it is time for what's next? 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. It's the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Glad to have you back here with us in the radio home of democracy. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, coast to coast. Tamara, or is it Tamara? It's Tamara, right? In Joplin, Pennsylvania?
Joplin, Missouri.
Joplin, Missouri. Okay.
Yes.
That's even better. Hey, well, that's also okay, let's say.
But yeah. I am a lone liberal groupie.
Okay.
Of the Lynn Cullen Show.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Hooked on her.
Oh, interesting. Great.
Yeah, she's a lone liberal. I called to comment about the Bolton nomination and the meeting that was on C-SPAN yesterday, because the liberal media has been reporting that the Democrats blocked the vote on the nomination on him yesterday. That's a blatant lie.
The Democrats don't have the power to block a vote in a committee.
Well, actually, it was just a meeting, and the Democrats voiced concern over new allegations against Bolton. And all through the meeting, Lugar, the chairman, kept trying to go for a vote.
Right.
And let me tell you, I never laughed so hard in my life as I did when Voinovich, a Republican,
right,
stood up and said, I'm not going to be voting yes on this guy. I'm going to be voting no, which meant that they would have been one vote short.
Right. And all of a sudden, Lugar is going,
Oh, all the Republicans started backpedaling. All of a sudden, Hagel says, well, I think maybe we should revisit Dodd's amendment again.
Yeah.
But it was so funny. And at the very end, after three or four times throughout the meeting, Lugar saying, let's vote, John Kerry, now that we all know they don't have the votes, John Kerry says, well, if you guys want to vote, we can. It was so good, Tom. Oh, God, it was so good when Kerry said that. And they're all like, no, we'll go ahead and vote later.
You know, now, that's really a remarkable story that you just shared with us, Tamara. And I didn't have an opportunity to see C-SPAN yesterday.
Well, you can get it on their website. Go to C-SPAN.org and look for the meeting of the Foreign Relations
Committee. But isn't it remarkable, though, that happened, you saw it, there was a bunch of reporters there. And that's not the story that's being carried in the national news or in the national newspapers. Instead, the Democrats are being vilified and the Republicans are being held up as some kinds of victims or
and
something.
And that is not what happened.
Yeah, that's
it's
amazing.
Exactly the opposite.
Absolutely amazing.
And
Tamara,
let me go. Can I do one thing?
You can do it if you can do it in 5 seconds.
For your Missouri listeners, go to www.FiredUpMissouri.com. It's a new website by Gene Carnahan.
You got it. FiredUpMissouri.com. Thanks a lot, Tamara. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes after the hour. What's up with Tom DeLay? Is there a left-wing conspiracy to drive this guy out of office? A good and noble civil servant who only tried to do the best he could to represent his district. Could it be? William Green is the president of RightMarch.com. And Mr. Green, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
I'm glad to have you here. I've been getting your conservative alerts since back when they used to be called conservativealerts.com. And still get them regularly, occasionally read them on the air. You're out. We got this press release saying that you were available to come on programs. You're out there doing the talk radio circuit, as it were, in defense of Tom DeLay. Why?
Because Tom DeLay has stood for us for so long that now that he is under the most incredible barrage of attacks since, I think, President Bush during the election, it's time to stand with him. We need to make sure that Tom DeLay is not, you know, thrown under the bus. This is a guy that has been probably the most effective conservative leader on Capitol Hill in a long, long time. That's why they're coming after him. That's why they're attacking him. And we want to make sure that we do everything we can to stand firm for him.
You know, I'll bet you're right. I'll bet that one of the main reasons why Tom DeLay is being aggressively attacked is because he has been so effective, and yet he's so corrupt. And in fact, a large part of his effectiveness comes out of his corruption, like bribing Nick Smith and then threatening him and then following through on the threat and making sure that Nick Smith's son never got into the House of Representatives.
Well, I mean, that's the kind of that's the kind of silliness that is being used so strongly against.
Well, I'm quoting a Republican member of Congress.
Which Republican member would that be?
Nick Smith.
He's a member now.
No longer, you know, thanks
right.
to Tom DeLay.
There's a long.
The hammer
list.
Fell.
There's a long list of Republicans that I think that either the New York Times or the Washington Post or both they went out looking for Republicans that would speak out against Tom DeLay, that would say that he needs to resign or something, and so they found a list of former Republican or former House members that, in fact, most folks around the Beltway wouldn't even remember any of these guys' names.
Well, I'm actually quoting Nick Smith from during the Medicare debate. I haven't talked to him or heard from him since then. But during the Medicare debate, Nick Smith went back to Michigan. And I'm on a couple of radio stations in Michigan, and I have family there. And, you know, this was a big story in Michigan. He went back to his district in Michigan and said, well, Tom DeLay came up to me and said that if I voted for the Medicare program that gave these, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to the pharmaceutical companies by preventing the government, by legally preventing the Medicare program from negotiating drug prices like the Pentagon does, they can't, you know, Medicare can't do what the Pentagon does and negotiate lower drug prices. He says, Tom DeLay came to me and said, if I would go along with this, he'd give $100,000 to me for my son's campaign and make sure that my son got my seat when I retire. And you know, this came out, and then he said, and he didn't vote the way that DeLay wanted him to, and boom, Nick Smith is no longer in Congress, and neither is his son.
Well,
doesn't that smell to you?
Charges of bribery would have to go to court. He's never been charged. DeLay's never been charged with bribery, and so it's sort of superfluous to use what some hearsay that this guy, who's obviously got, you know, sour grapes over the fact that, again, Tom DeLay is effective at you know, if there are folks that are going against the conservative Republican agenda, then he's going to work with other conservatives and Republicans to make sure they get defeated. We do the same thing. Democrats do the same thing on their side. If people are going against the liberal Democrat agenda, they work to get them defeated too, and replaced with someone they like. That's just politics right there. There's nothing illegal about that. There's nothing unethical about it.
So what about, for example, Tom DeLay using money from the Department of Homeland Security to track down Democrats in Texas?
Well, again, there's absolutely no proof that he did that sort of thing. What we have here is laundry list that people are just trying to put together of, oh, well, we should investigate them on this. Oh, wait, let's investigate them on this.
Well, I'm just curious about a few of these things. The Westar Energy Company said that they had to come up with $56,000 to get a, quote, seat at the table, and which they did, by the way. I mean, these people are supporters.
Well, again, Tom DeLay hasn't done anything, and let me really extend this thought, because I know what you're going to say, so let me extend this thought.
Right.
Tom DeLay hasn't done anything that's not normally done in Washington, D.C., whether it's Democrat or Republican. In fact, the Democrats usually do a lot more than what Tom DeLay has done.
Well, let's clean
that
the whole mess
mean,
up.
That doesn't mean that the standard operating procedure in Washington, D.C., is the correct operating procedure. What it means is that everyone does do it, and
you're defending that.
No, what I'm saying is, if people don't want that type of activity going on in Washington, then number one, the detractors of DeLay need to stop being hypocrites and need to go after all the Democrats that have done a lot more than him. And number
two,
if the people don't like it, then they need to get their congressmen and their senators to change the rules, to write new laws, and to stop everybody from doing it. Have you noticed not a single Democrat has come forward to say, we need to pass new laws stopping everyone from engaging in this standard behavior that goes on in Washington, D.C.? No, what they're doing is they're simply using this for their own political advantage to try to stop Tom DeLay, because he has been such an incredibly effective leader.
You think the Democrats are not saying to the Ethics Committee, hey, do something about this?
No, the Democrats are not saying something to them, except in a hypocritical fashion. Keep in mind, again, the Ethics Committee is not even being allowed to sit right now because the Democrats are stopping it from sitting.
But what about Tom DeLay replacing two of the Republican members of the Ethics Committee who were willing to be critical of him with two folks from Texas who receive money from him?
Say it again, because I missed part of that.
I said, what about Tom DeLay having replaced two Republican members of the Ethics Committee who were critical of him with Republicans from Texas who are taking money from Tom DeLay?
No, that's not what happened. Number one, you had the chairman, and this is what the Democrats have objected to the most about the Ethics Committee,
okay,
is that the Republican who was the chairman, when he came up for reappointment, the House rules say that all Republican committee chairmen are term limited by these rules that were adopted back in 95 by the House of Representatives. Heffley's term was up. This was Congressman Heffley. His term was up. He had to be replaced, but he objected, and he said he objected in the media, saying that he was replaced because he had said things against Tom DeLay. But the fact of the matter is that Speaker of the House Hastert, who he doesn't have a partisan bone in his body, told Heffley that he was going to follow the rules and replaced him. And the Democrats saw this as this great opportunity to protest, and so they refused to meet, so that committee can't function. But as a result of that committee not being able to function, that means DeLay can't get a ruling from the Ethics Committee which would affirm what it told DeLay earlier, which was that his action was permissible under House rules. And so the whole thing, and in fact, if this Ethics Committee were to get back together, then one of the things they would need to consider would be the case of Congressman Jim McDermott, who's broken the law and would probably have to lose his seat. But the Democrats aren't going to vote to make one of their own lose their seat. So once again, they're going to stop all this from taking place and try to make themselves look good in the process.
Would you say it's safe to say that what the Democrats are doing to Tom DeLay right now is similar to what the Republicans did to Bill Clinton?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. In fact,
you think that Bill Clinton's having sex with Monica Lewinsky and lying about it in that investigation is a greater crime than the allegations that have been made against Tom DeLay about taking illegal money,
well,
taking illegal trips, getting kickbacks?
DeLay, the allegations of Tom DeLay have absolutely no standing. They have no merit. Everything that has tried to be thrown against Tom DeLay does not stick, and the reason it doesn't stick is because none of it has a leg to stand on. He's broken no laws. He's violated no rules, but they just keep trying and trying. This is the reason he's going to survive this, is because nothing they try is going to stick, because he's not done anything wrong. The reason that it stuck against Bill Clinton is because he did all those things wrong.
Well, it might have had something to do with $70 million spent to investigate it.
Well, have you seen how much money is being spent by these liberal groups to come against Tom DeLay?
I have not seen...
Every one of these groups is either funded by George Soros, or the people on the boards of these groups are also on the boards of these other groups that are funded by George Soros. We've got a multi-billionaire here who's doing everything he can to come against Tom DeLay and come against a conservative agenda in Washington. And so they've got plenty of the money to do this.
William Green, president of RightMarch.com. Do you really think that George Soros has put as much money into politics as, for example, Richard Mellon Scaife or Joe Coors?
He's put more than any of these folks. He's a multi-billionaire. The guy's got so much money, and he wants to make that kind of impact. And he
the guys who created the Heritage Foundation 20 years ago?
Absolutely, absolutely. Soros has gone way beyond any of these other folks.
Huh. And well, that's so. I'll have to send him a thank you card. I think that's great.
You probably should.
Yeah, let's take a couple of quick calls here. Chris in Abiquiu, New Mexico, is on the line with a question for William Green, president of RightMarch.com. Hey, Chris.
Hi, gentlemen. Yeah, first and foremost, just as an aside, I'd like to say that I am against the end of the filibuster in the Senate, but it's only because I don't like Christians. Nothing political on my side on that.
That's a weird statement, Chris. I'm sorry.
When are politicians going to realize that the old, I'm innocent, it's just mean people want to get me defense, is not going to work? It didn't work for McCarthy. It didn't work for Nixon. It didn't work for Clinton. It's not going to work for DeLay. The man is bringing down his own party, and I'm kind of happy about that. And you have people who are just blithering and lying, not for money, but simply for ideology in this case. And I'm finding it all very entertaining.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
You're welcome. Thanks, Chris. You want to respond to that?
Sure. If the man was actually taking down his own party, you wouldn't have all the leadership of the Democratic Party doing everything they can to take him down now. Obviously, the reason they're coming after him in the way they are, and in the hypocritical fashion they are, considering what they themselves do so much, is because he really is so effective, and he really does help his party in such a strong way. If they thought he was ineffective, or if they thought he was hurting his party, they'd do everything they could to make sure he stayed exactly
okay.
Where he was.
Speaking of the theys, Tom DeLay specifically has been criticized by the Wall Street Journal, by David Brooks, by Newt Gingrich, by Bob Dole, by Representatives Christopher Shea and Tom Tancredo, and at least 10 conservative ex-congressmen. These are all part of a left-wing conspiracy?
Think about the list that you just gave there. Number one, Newt Gingrich. Well, Newt Gingrich has had a vendetta against Tom DeLay for a long time. They really had it out with each other because Tom DeLay led an aborted coup against Gingrich when Gingrich was Speaker of the House. So, of course, Gingrich is going to come out and say things. But you don't hear the press talking about the animosity between the two and the political problems between the two when they talk about Gingrich. Shays is a liberal. Of course, they're going to go to someone like Shays.
A liberal Republican.
Oh, a strong liberal Republican. He barely won his last election.
Tom Tancredo's no liberal Republican. I've had him on this program.
But Tom Tancredo came out after all the coverage that he got. You know, he never gets any coverage at all about his actual conservative stances, especially on being against illegal immigration.
Well, that's what I had him on this show for. I've seen him on a lot of media about
that. But he's all over the front pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post because they said, oh, he came out and said that DeLay needs to step down. No, Tancredo came out just this 3 days ago and said that the charges against DeLay are trumped up, that they lack merit, and they're leveled in the hopes of bringing him down, and all he then at that point said was it may be a productive move for him to take a temporary leave of absence, but you don't see anyone ever. In fact, of the 29 mainstream press reports on Tancredo's statement that you can get from LexisNexis, 14 omitted his temporarily qualifier. And so you've got
that's not right, that's not fair.
Don't misquote me on this stuff because he's a supporter of Tom DeLay.
Okay, well, you're an articulate spokesman for that for Tom DeLay's position, and I appreciate your having the courage to come on this program, William Green.
And
share it with us. President of RightMarch.com, www.rightmarch.com, if you want more information about that. Thank you very much for being with us, and have a great day, Mr. Green. It is 20 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I feel
good. I knew that I wouldn't. Well, this is not Tom DeLay's song. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. Although it may be if he comes out intact. So good. So good. Day three of the Tom DeLay political death watch. Does he have us? As Gary Trudeau is playing it out in Doonesbury. When you've made Doonesbury, you know you've made the big time. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number for our radio program if you'd like to drop in, say hi, have questions, comments, thoughts, arguments. I love arguments. Conservatives, please call. And if you want to drop into our chat room, you're welcome to. TomHartman.com will get you there. It has filled up considerably. So let's get back to the lines here. Dave in Humboldt County, California on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program. Welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Good morning, Tom. I'm not the conservative you're looking for, but I was hoping your guest would have been able to stay a little bit longer because one of the things I personally feel, we have such a dreadfully corrupt government. I believe we've got that corrupt government because of these crooked voting machines. I also believe we've still got the voting machines because while several congressmen have introduced bills to have them made verifiable, one-time delay, as I understand it, says that bill will come to a vote when pigs fly over the Capitol Dome. And that's...
Oh, really? He said that about Rush Holt's bill?
That's what I understand. I'm giving it to you.
If you find that quote, let me know if you can find a source for that. I would love to see a source for that.
It was something very much to that effect, but yeah. He has no intentions of allowing it to come to a vote. And that's what this guest would think is a part of his effectiveness, his value to the country.
Yeah. Remarkable. Well, Dave, you know, what I should have done is I should have said to Mr. Green, William Green, and I'm not sure why I wasn't calling him William. It's let's get into this. Anybody named William, I feel like I should call him Mr. Anyway, what I should have said to him was, well, now that George Soros is thinking of getting into the election machine business, I think things might turn around. And, you know, just plant a little seed of paranoia and see if it would propagate across the blogosphere. And wouldn't it be great to see that show up on Newsmax.com and that kind of thing? The liberals are thinking of buying or building a voting machine company. I'll tell you, that would do it. That would do it. Dave, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Judy Ann in Michigan's on the line. Hey, Judy Ann.
Hi. I haven't talked to you in my ages.
Well, I'm so glad you called.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you like it. We're in Oregon?
Yes, in Portland, Oregon. Yeah.
Well, I hope it's warmer there than it is in Michigan.
It's 68 today. It's beautiful.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Well,
it's been storming here.
Oh, my.
The temperatures are going back into the 50s.
Yeah, well, you know, summer's coming to Michigan. Summers in Michigan are absolutely beautiful.
Yeah,
but, Judy, we've only got 2 minutes. What's on your mind?
You know what you said a while ago about Clinton and that sex scandal thing
mm-hmm.
he had?
Yeah.
How many presidents over the past, I mean, you know, I'm not over 100 years old, thank God, has had sex with somebody while they were in the White House, and they didn't try to impeach him?
I would guess that probably the only one who didn't was Jerry Ford and Jimmy Carter. I'd say Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, I would be really surprised if I learned.
I know my aunt told me, I don't remember which one it was now, she's gone now, but she said there was one president, I think that might have been back in the 1800s or something, that actually had gotten his mistress pregnant and moved her into the White House.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So,
well,
I mean,
he didn't move her into the White House, but he paid for the baby for years, and he was public about it. And I'm forgetting which one it was. I want to say it was McKinley, but it was in the late 19th
sure
century.
Either.
And, yeah.
But why make a big deal on a Clinton?
Well, because they could.
Because
they could. And what's so ironic is that at the same time that you had Bob Barr and Newt Gingrich and Livingston out there just ripping apart Bill Clinton for having had an affair and setting a bad moral example, all three of them were having sex with their secretaries or their interns at the same time they were on the floor of the House impeaching Bill Clinton for it.
Yeah.
I mean, there were actually five
Republicans
who ended up being outed for that.
Used fraud to get in there?
Yeah, no, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Judy Ann, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I do appreciate your taking the time to call in. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. You are in the real free speech zone. The Tom Hartman radio program, 29 minutes past the hour.
But, Dad...
Tyler, we've been over this three times. There'll be no adults at Ed's house Friday night. No.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine.
Well, not Tom DeLay's song.
I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Definitely not Tom DeLay's song. Welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Tom DeLay sent out a 2,538-word memo, email, talking point, whatever, screed to his constituents back in Sugarland, Texas, and neighboring burgs. 1,273 words devoted to complaining about other people's conduct. Remarkable. I'll share a few other startling facts with you after we take a couple of phone calls. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Rick in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Yes, Tom. I tuned in just as your guest was leaving. You were letting the callers interact with him, right?
I was, but he was only going to be on for 13 minutes, you know, until 20 minutes after the hour. And so,
well,
you know, we had that limit.
Just let me say this. It takes Tom DeLay, I guess, to make Newt Gingrich look statesmanlike, doesn't it? and you remember Dick Armey was another guy.
Good one, Rick. Good one.
Dick Armey and DeLay were known as the Texas Twins, and I thought I read somewhere that they had a falling out to the point of where it almost went to fisticuffs, and of course Armey's quite a big man, but I thought your guest there, the apologist, was just shameless in how he, you know, and you left Rick Santorum, I don't think you mentioned him, but it's like everybody that Tom DeLay is criticized by, he's either a liberal Republican or he's an unethical person like Gingrich. Or
it was taken out of context.
Now let's look at it this way. Tom DeLay did try to take Gingrich on in a coup. Why wasn't that considered disloyal? Because right now, if DeLay is booted out, and I hope he is, he'll be replaced by another Republican, and how is that any difference than what DeLay was trying to do to Gingrich? I would think if these loyal Republicans, you know,
The bottom line, what you're talking about, Rick, is logic, and the bottom line is really, I mean, William Green was actually being truthful with us when he said that Tom DeLay has been very, very effective, and you know, therefore, in his mind, there's this conspiracy that he projects, you know, his paranoid perspective on this conspiracy to take him out. But the other, therefore, there's a, I don't want to say conspiracy, an organized effort on the part of Republicans to support him, to keep him in. And there's truth to that.
Except there are a lot of dissenters. And, of course, if you want to talk about effectiveness, would the Republicans even be in this position? Were it not for Gingrich? Where was the outrage among Republicans when DeLay tried to get Gingrich out of there?
Yeah.
I didn't hear that.
No, you didn't. And it wasn't widely known, for that matter. I mean, it was just that was a small, short time span thing, other than the fact that there was a lot of animosity there, because these guys were both power junkies.
Now Dennis Hastert, of course, even though he may be sort of a figurehead, of course, is the Speaker of the House.
But then he's a go-along guy.
Well, what I was
he's an old wrestling coach. He's a team player.
Well, what I was going to say is this is not necessarily about ideology, because I'll bet if you check the voting records, he's just as conservative. The fact is that Tom DeLay is a mean guy, and that's the reason he has so many enemies. It's not ideology.
On the right and on the left, yeah. I think he sniffed too much bug killer.
You know, there you go.
It's the only thing I can come up with.
Sounds logical.
Yeah. Rick, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
To hear from you. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Dana in Chicago has some information for us. Hey, Dana.
Well, hello, Tom.
Hello.
I have to be very careful what I say about this because I only have part of the story, but there were two presidents that had illegitimate children that were big scandals. One of them was Grover Cleveland.
Yes, and yes.
And okay. The other one was Warren Gamelol Harding.
Yes.
Who made Nan Britton pregnant, and there was a huge scandal. I have two books that were written by friends of Nan Britton in the 1920s
mm-hmm.
about that. One was The President's Daughter.
Yes.
By Nan Britton.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. And neither of those illegitimate children or mistresses moved into the White House, but one of them was openly acknowledged while the president was president. Wasn't that Harding?
No.
Because
Mrs. Harding would have had a fit.
Ah, yes, okay.
It had to have been Grover Cleveland.
That's right. Okay, yes, Grover Cleveland was the earlier one. That was 1886 when Cleveland was president. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Okay, well, Dana, thank you for those facts.
I just love old gossip.
There you go. And I have the smartest listeners of any radio program on earth. I'm so pleased and so honored. Thanks a lot for calling, Dana.
Thanks, Tom. Bye-bye.
Bye now. It's 22 minutes before the hour. DeLay's Dirty Dozen. Well, we'll get to that in just a minute. I want to deal with this memo of Tom DeLay's. He sent out a 2,538-word memo. Now, first of all, if it takes you the length of a standard solid, good-sized chapter in a major book to explain why you didn't do something. In all probability, you did it, number one. I mean, it's just kind of a general rule of thumb, right? Number two, interesting, let's look at what was in the memo. Now, first of all, some of the things that DeLay has been accused of, but one of the concerns. Back in 1997... What? That's in ancient history. Well, so was Jennifer Flowers. But in any case, in 1997, Abramoff, this, you know, the, remember him? He's Jack Abramoff. He's this lobbyist. He arranges a junket to Saipan. Now, Saipan is this little Pacific island. It's an American territory, sort of like... like the Philippines were like Puerto Rico is, in a way. But they're, because of the import laws and tax laws and all kinds of things, labor is really cheap in Saipan, and so it has become basically a place where you the two main industries are sweatshops and the sex trade, and you know that's pretty much what's going on there. And so DeLay and Abramoff and a former DeLay aide make this lavish overseas trip to Saipan, along with DeLay's wife and daughter and several aides. And Abramoff writes a memo obtained by ABC News that says, quote, such trips are one of the most effective ways to build permanent friends on the Hill, end quote. The Saipan junket is part of Abramoff's effort to, quote, stop legislation aimed at cracking down on sweatshops and sex shops, end quote, on the island. A prominent factory owner on the island says DeLay, quote, promised to stop the reform laws, end quote. You get this? The Tom DeLay shilling for the sex trade and for the sweatshop business in Saipan. And doing so lavishly. And then in 2000, Abramoff again finances another little trip for DeLay. And at that time, now Abramoff, he's not representing sweatshops in Saipan, or sex shops apparently, he's now representing an internet gambling company. Now, first of all, here's a guy who's representing sweatshops and sex shops and internet gambling, and he's Tom DeLay's best, you know, close, whatever. I was going to say best friend. That would be an exaggeration. But he's giving Tom DeLay all these trips. Here you go. Off you go. We're going to go to Saipan. We're going to go to Ireland. We're going to go to wherever it may be. And all over Europe. And you would think that DeLay, who pretends to be or says that he's representing Republican conservative values, would be a little concerned about taking a lot of money from a guy whose business is representing gambling operations and prostitution operations and sweatshop operations. Wouldn't you think so? But in 2000, Abramoff helps finance a European vacation, gets DeLay to kill internet gambling provision. Abramoff serves as go-between for a deal where eLottery, an online gaming company, helps finance a European vacation for DeLay. 2 months later, DeLay helps kill the Internet Gambling Prohibition Act, which, quote, would have made it a federal crime to place certain bets over the Internet and was opposed by eLottery and the Choctaws, which is the Indian tribe that had also hired Abramoff. They got their money's worth. DeLay is one of those guys, you invest a few million or invest a few thousand, and you can make hundreds of millions. You can make billions. Invest in your government. So he sends out this memo. The number of references in this memo to DeLay ally and corrupt lobbyist Jack Abramoff. This is out of 2,538 words, and this is one of the main charges against him. The number of times he referenced this guy in this memo, in which he was explaining to his constituents what's going on, the number of times he referenced Jack Abramoff, zero. The number of times, this is from the thinkprogress.org site, by the way, the number of times the email portrays DeLay opponents as partisan or politically motivated? 25. The number of references to high-profile criticisms of DeLay from the Wall Street Journal, David Brooks, Newt Gingrich, Bob Dole, Representatives Christopher Shea and Tom Tancredo, and at least 10 conservative ex-congressmen, 0. The number of times the email claims that the media is treating him unfairly, 4. Now, interestingly, okay, 4 times he says, the media is wrong. They're treating me unfairly. 4 times he says that. The number of times the exact same email quotes the media to help DeLay make his case, to bolster his case, 4. The same number of times. Now, this is a really interesting one. Travis County District Attorney Ronnie Earle. Apparently the District Attorney's Office is not a partisan, you don't run for it as a member of a party. As far as I know, I may be wrong on that, but I don't think so. I think it's a nonpartisan position. Travis County District Attorney Ronnie Earle is referred to as partisan by Tom DeLay 12 times in his memo. In other words, Ronnie Earle is taking the position of a particular political party. He's working to help one party and harm another. This, Tom DeLay is saying in this memo. Okay. So how many times has Ronnie Earle actually prosecuted politicians? Total of 15 times in his 27-year career. Now, of those 15 politicians, if this guy's a partisan politician pursuer, what would the word be? Partisan politician prosecutor, if that's what he is. No, we're not going to go there, Louise. Not Ronnie Earle. We could say that. You didn't say it on the air. We could say that of Tom DeLay. Anyhow, we're not going to go there. The number of Democrats prosecuted by Earle during his 27-year career, 12. The number of Republicans prosecuted by Earle during his 27-year career, 3. So apparently Tom DeLay is right. Travis County District Attorney Ronnie Earle is a partisan politician prosecutor. He prosecutes Democrats. DeLay doesn't share that fact with his readers, though. References to the fact that former Representative Chris Bell, Democrat of Texas, was found to have violated procedural rules when he included inflammatory language in his formal complaint against DeLay. 6. The guy broke the rules when he made his complaint against DeLay. 6 times DeLay mentions that. How many times does DeLay mention the fact that the Ethics Committee accepted Bell's complaint, even though it included inflammatory language, because, quote, it also contained allegations that warranted committee consideration? How many times did he mention that? 0. Out of a total of 2,538 words, Tom DeLay saw fit to devote 1,273 of those words to complaining about other people's conduct. What specifically did he do? He's embroiled in a scandal in Texas for his active participation in illegally funneling corporate funds to assist state political campaigns. He had a political action committee. This is from the Center for American Progress. They put together this little DeLay's Dirty Dozen, which is a very good summary. No doubt an organization funded by George Soros. May well be. Probably is. DeLay's Political Action Committee. Don't you just love the paranoia? Well, okay. What is funded by Reverend Moon? The Washington Times! What's funded by Rupert Murdoch? Fox News! How much money has Fox News lost since it started? Over $1 billion! How about the Washington Times? About the same! As I recall, I may be a little off on those numbers, but not by much. Washington Times is still losing money. Fox News has started making money in the last year or so. Anyhow, DeLay raises corporate cash for TRMPAC, T-R-M-P-A-C, his political action committee, the Texans for a Republican Majority. It's under criminal investigation for using corporate money to finance Texas campaigns. Under criminal investigation. It is a crime in the state of Texas to take corporate money and use it for politics. Documents showed DeLay was, quote, personally forwarded at least one large check, or that he did, that he personally forwarded at least one large check, end quote, to this group, to his Texans for Republican majority, and was, quote, in direct contact with lobbyists for some of the nation's largest companies, end quote, on TrimPAC's behalf. He uses taxpayer money for a partisan stunt, chasing the Democrats who were trying to flee the redistricting, you'll recall that, offering Nick Smith $100,000 for his vote on the Medicare deal, using his children's charity, Celebrations for Children, Inc., as a cover for collecting soft money from anonymous interest groups, such as some of which was used for dinners, a golf tournament, a rock concert, Broadway tickets, other fundraising events. DeLay promises a seat at the table for a donor, Westar Energy Incorporated, $56,500 they coughed up, and he said, and they said, you know, in an email, hey, this is going to get us a seat at the table. That's what they needed. And they got the legislation. This was back in 2002. He takes money from a Texas prison company with legislation pending. They gave him $100,000. CCA, Correction Corporation of America, blocks legislation for a partisan vendetta. On it goes. 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brusho, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman because you're intelligent, progressive, and like the thousands of members.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
If you want it, here it is. Come and get it. Make your mind up fast.
Ah, yes. Come and get it, my friends. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number exposing the con in conservative. Well, our stuff finally arrived yesterday. The movers hauling our belongings from Vermont to Oregon. I still feel a little bit like Tom Hanks in the Money Pit movie. Did you see that thing? We've discovered the dishwasher's croaked, the roof is leaking, the movers freaked out at this long kind of bridge that you've got to cross to get to where the floating houses are. The salesperson of the moving company kept saying, no problem. But when they got here, they were like, well, let's see your credit card. You know the drill. And Higgins, our cat, is just itching to take on a goose. He has been absolutely at the window. And I'm telling you, the geese are bigger than Higgins. Of course, this is a cat that the last time somebody brought a dog to the house, he flew across the room. And we caught him just before he attached himself to the dog's head. And the dog won't come in the house anymore. And this is a big dog. It's like a 40-pound dog. So Higgins wants to take on the geese. I don't think Higgins would win, but you never know. So just an update on, you know, what's happening here. Portland, Oregon, it rained all last week. It's supposed to be sunny all this week. So that's kind of nice. It's up to 68 today. Religious prejudice pervasive, cadets say. This from the Associated Press, article by Robert Weller. Byline, the Air Force Academy, Colorado. Less than 2 years after it was plunged into a rape scandal, the Air Force Academy is scrambling to address complaints that evangelical Christians wield so much influence at the school that anti-Semitism and other forms of religious harassment have become pervasive. Now, this is where this concerns me, and the reason that I bring this up, is that we are seeing this swing to the right religiously. We now have a new, very, very conservative pope, the guy who is in charge of the office that used to be the office of the Inquisition. They refer to him as Pope John Paul II's enforcer. So the Tom DeLay of the Vatican is now the pope. And you have, you know, Tom DeLay, who is now Tom DeLay, and we'll see what happens with that. You have George Bush playing the religion card. You have Bill Friss this Sunday doing the, you know, let's whip up the people of faith. I mean, people who really are there for a reason, something positive, and just cynically exploiting them. Is Bill Friss going to be out there, this evangelical group? It just concerns me. Concerns me that this could become something that is not what is good for either religion or America, ultimately. Thanks for being with us this hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, where despair is not an option. Get active!
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can...
The man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back here in the Democracy Zone. There we go. What a beautiful day. You know, every day you wake up breathing is a beautiful day. we have to, particularly in these dark times politically, we have to take our light where we can find it. Did you see in today's Wall Street Journal? This is absolutely incredible. This is our China alert, as it were. Absolutely incredible. This is mind-boggling. The manufacturers of textiles, or textiles, depending on what part of the country you're from, the textile manufacturers in the United States, those people who make fabric, who make shirts, who make pants, who make socks, not many of them left. But there are a few. You know, John Edwards talked about how they're all gone. His father worked in the mills and all that kind of thing. Not many of them left. But there still are a few around, and the manufacturers of textiles in the United States have been saying in increasing numbers, please put the tariffs on textiles back. We had the situation here where the textile tariffs were taken off. The tariffs were taken off textiles just a few months ago, a month or two ago, and now there's been this explosion, these final tariffs. A tariff is a tax, by the way, on the import or export of a product. And so these were taxes on the import of clothing, fabric, raw fabric or finished clothing into the United States, or other textile products as well, things like draperies, I don't know what else would be made out of textile, flags, presumably. Anyhow, the tariffs were removed, and when they removed the tariffs, suddenly Chinese exports surged. I told you about this last month. We saw... My recollection is there was something like a 30%, 20-30% leap, bang, just like that. And everybody had said, of course, in the Bush administration, oh, don't worry, we'll take off the tariffs because our campaign donors, the big retailers like Walmart, one of the leaders in not wanting there to be tariffs on Chinese goods, our campaign donors, the Republicans say, who have led America into a deal with the devil, essentially, with China, in my opinion, they really don't want there to be taxes on these things. So they can bring them in cheap and so they can make more profits. I mean, Walmart last year made $10 billion in profits. $20,000 a minute. In profits, not revenues, profits. So the manufacturers of textiles, the few left in the United States, have been saying, please, please, hey, we've got to do something about this. We've got to figure out a way to reduce the amount of the stuff coming into the United States. There's just, it's at these prices, we can't compete. There's just too much of it. What can we do? Well, put the tariffs back on. And this is the old, you know, cost of labor thing. I've said this a million times. If something costs a dollar, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of jeans made here, and 10 cents worth of labor and a pair of jeans made in China, then put a 90 cent tax on the import. Now, I got an email this morning, interestingly, from a fellow in, as I recall, it was Finland, maybe it was Denmark, one of the Scandinavian countries, in which he said, well, you're correct in pointing out that there's differences in labor costs, but he said there are also differences in energy costs. And energy is a large part of the cost of producing something. And in Europe, people pay five times as much for energy as they do in the United States. Now, he also said in the third world, they pay five times as much for energy. I've done a lot of work and I've spent months in, probably cumulatively at least a year, in various third world countries around the world, in South America, in Central America, in Africa, in southern Asia, in India, in China. And my recollection is that gas was cheap in all those places. I don't recall, frankly, any third world country where gas was real expensive. Not like it is in Europe. So I suspect, respectfully, that my correspondent is mistaken. Although I'm willing to be corrected if I'm wrong on this. You know, somebody let me know. But because it's been a few years since I've really been in third world countries noticing these kinds of things. It's been probably 5 or 10 years, actually. But in any case, here you have the situation where the tariffs should be put on there by the United States. Now, two benefits come out of that. One, we protect our domestic industries. Manufacturers in the United States are protected because for Walmart, if they're going to have to buy it from a company in South Carolina and pay for that dollar's worth of labor in the product, or if they're going to have to buy it from China and only pay 10 cents for the labor, but there's a 90-cent tax on the import of it, the tariff, so it works out to a dollar, the cost is the same, might as well buy it from South Carolina. Then you can brag about American made. And you get to look like a good citizen and all that kind of thing. Well, that goes out the window when profits are involved. But the import tariffs makes perfect sense, number one, for that reason. And number two, because import tariffs generate revenue. Import tariffs make money. When products come into the United States and the importers have to pay a tax on them, that money goes into the coffers of the U.S. Treasury. And it helps. It would help reduce our budget deficit. All kinds of good things could be. We could use it to build schools. We could build it to rebuild our highways and bridges. We could use it to update our internet systems, our infrastructure. There's so many different things that could be done with it. So tariffs makes perfect sense, right? Well, the Chinese agree because they've been getting so much political flack from manufacturers in the United States about the explosion of Chinese exports of textiles. The Chinese, according to the Wall Street Journal, the Chinese, well, let me just read it to you straight. I mean, it's pretty unbelievable, so I'll just read it to you straight. This is an article from the front page of today's Wall Street Journal by Mei Fong, Dateline Hong Kong. China, here's the first paragraph, in its entirety. China is set to impose sharply higher tariffs on textile exports to try to head off a protectionist backlash in markets abroad as its garment sales soar, manufacturers and retailers say. You get that? China is going to say, yes, there should. China is saying, yes, there should be a tariff. There should be a protective tariff on export on textiles manufactured in China because the labor is so much cheaper. There should be an export tariff, or there should be a tariff. And we're going to charge it if America doesn't. So where does that tax money go? Where does that tariff money go? It goes to support the Red Army in murdering more Tibetans. It goes to support the Chinese police departments in imprisoning more dissenters, more democracy advocates. It goes to build more nuclear weapons. It goes to build more weapons that they are threatening Taiwan with. Does it seem to you that this just isn't quite the way it should be? As much as 50 cents an item from 2 to 3 cents. Here's the whole sentence. She expected Beijing, this is a quote from Janet Fox, JCPenney Corporation. As she expected Beijing would raise duties to as much as 50 cents an item from 2 or 3 cents, and the tariffs could kick in as early as May 1st. That's in a week and a half. More or less. China is going to a 50 cent an item tariff, an export tariff. The impact will be huge, said Harry Lee, managing director of Hong Kong shirtmaker TAL Apparel Limited, which has manufacturing facilities in southern China. He said the expected move could raise TAL's export tariffs tenfold to about $3.5 million a year. In other words, they're paying $350,000 a year right now in export taxes to China. China already has tariffs on their exports. And now it's going to go up to $3.5 million. Chinese textile exports surged 29% in the first 3 months of the year compared with a year earlier. There's that number. 29%. The overall U.S. trade deficit, meanwhile, pushed to a monthly record in February of $61.04 billion. That's how much money we had to borrow from other countries in order to buy goods from them. Get it? When you buy something from Walmart, you are, in effect, borrowing from the Chinese in order to, and the Chinese and the Saudis, in order to buy that. It's not quite that direct. The effect is the same. Actually, you're putting money in the pockets of the Walton family, and they're not paying taxes on it. And then the government is, we need not get into the whole thing. Anyhow, raising export duties is the best and quickest way for China to show it is proactive, said Willie Lin, vice chairman of the Hong Kong Textile Council. Beijing is also considering, they note, a minimum pricing program. Meanwhile, the European Commission is looking at the possibility of putting tariffs, import tariffs, on textiles from China. This stuff is hurting, you know, the textile industry in China. So let's put a tariff on it. At the same time, now, China and Japan are starting to ramp up their conflict. Japan has a lot of factories in China. They manufacture a lot of goods in China, a lot of things that even have Japanese labels on them. Many of the parts, if not most of the parts, are made in China because the Japanese manufacturers have been doing the exact same thing that American manufacturers are doing, which is exporting their jobs to China. Although they do have sufficient protectionist legislation that wholesale industries haven't been being wiped out. They've really been exporting a lot of their growth to China. Well, the Chinese are now saying to the Japanese, you know, you have been the regional superpower in this area for a long time. You've been the guys who were the big dog, you know, in the neighborhood or whatever. You carried the big stick, whatever metaphor you want to use. And now China wants to be that. They have nuclear weapons. They have the world's largest army. They are, they say, now a superpower. And it's pretty hard to deny. They are militarizing at an alarming rate in anticipation of what? Well, they're getting ready to back down China. And they are telling us that we should back off on support of Taiwan. A Chinese dictatorship telling us that we should back off in supporting a democracy. Something wrong with that, too. So today's newspaper, a couple of stories here that concern me. The main reason why being that the first demonstrates our economic weakness, our absolute vulnerability to China. We have put ourselves in a position where they could just strangle us by simply saying, we're not going to buy your treasury bills anymore. Or we're not going to sell you computer chips to make missiles anymore. And on the other hand, where they're saying, you know, these historic alliances like with Japan, you know, trade relationships, we're willing to blow those off when it becomes politically useful. We're competing with Japan now for oil, so we're going to blow off our relationship with them. That's essentially what China is saying. And the day is going to come, and it's not going to come very long from now, when China is going to be saying to us, you know, we're competing with you for oil, too. In fact, China just signed a huge contract with Iran. And if Bush gets his way and we go into Iran, we may have China to face. Chew on that one for a little bit. 20 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's tit for tat, but heck, you know all that. So when George number one brought in the big guns and chased me out of Kuwait, tried to set me straight, I arranged a little hit on that Texas twit. Well, it didn't quite work. I felt like a jerk.
Oh, it's the Saddam song. Yes, indeed. Welcome back. I was trying to figure out what's what. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with our daily report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well, very interesting in Washington, D.C. It's 88 degrees, and we could be going up to 90. So basically, you know, we're beside ourselves, and we don't quite know what to do.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you see
yourself beside yourself?
No, I really can't. I'm beyond that. I'm spinning at this point.
I see.
I'm so giddy. But meanwhile, the president isn't being giddy. He is, in fact, saying that the Congress needs to pass his energy bill. And
the oil industry needs its $8 billion in welfare money.
Well, it certainly does. And he says that, you know, the price of oil needs to come down, and passing his energy bill, which he says he's been trying to do for 4 years, is the way to do it.
No, but he's been obstructed by those awful people who control the House of Representatives and the Senate, the Republicans.
That's it. Well, the thing is that if there were just a few more Republicans, they could stop the Democrats completely, and then he could get his thing through.
I see. Because the Republican majority is not enough to pass legislation?
No, but if they get rid of that pesky filibuster thing...
Ah, yes. Well, there is that, yes.
That could help. Yeah. So I attended the White House press briefing today with Scott McClellan. He was talking about that, answering questions about it. He was also answering questions, not surprisingly, about the nomination of John Bolton to U.S. Ambassador at the United Nations.
Uh-huh.
And I asked Scott a couple of questions about this, and they'll be up on the Talk Radio News Service website later today. So if you're interested in hearing him dancing on the head of a pin, you can do so. Because what he said was that the Democrats playing politics, it's the worst type of Washington. The Democrats playing politics, trying to score points against the president with these unsubstantiated allegations.
Oh, yes. Well, we had actually the president of RightMarch.com on this morning. This is not the Bolton thing, but the delay thing. And he was talking about those are the same talking points. You know, this is just the Democrats and George Soros, that nasty George Soros. He's up to no good.
Oh, yes, the anti-Semite George Soros, yes.
Yes, yes. As the cons say it, yes.
Yes. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, because I was watching the meeting of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday. It was absolutely fascinating. I mean, it really was must-see TV. It was C-SPAN, but it could have been 24 on Fox. It was so exciting because they were about to take the vote, and, you know, the Democrats were trying to slow it down. I didn't want to take the vote, and then suddenly Senator Voinovich from Ohio steps up and says that he's not comfortable, and
yes,
nobody expected that. I mean,
well,
he's a gasp.
He said, "My conscience got to me." Say what?
I know.
Say what?
I think he provided some cover for Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, who I suspect, this is just me thinking, but I think he may have been quite glad of the cover, quite honestly, because one of his staffers is one of the people John Bolton went after at some point.
Well, and Hagel wants to run for president in 2008, and he's doing everything he can to position himself for it. On the one hand, he needs all the support he can get within the Republican Party, and on the other hand, he needs to distance himself as much as he can from the extremists in the party, like Bolton.
It's very interesting. McClellan was making it very clear that they're not considering, you know, changing their priorities, that Bolton is the man for the job.
Well, you know, they always say there's no plan B 5 minutes before they announce plan B.
Well, precisely. So that was really very interesting. Having asked my two questions, I didn't get a chance to go and ask my follow-up, which was, could you tell us what other names are under consideration, which I think he would have blown a gasket at that point. But I'll try and ask tomorrow.
Okay. That's great. What any other hot things? Today, President Bush is signing the bankruptcy bill, is he not?
He's signing the bankruptcy bill.
Do you know who's going to be in the room with him?
No, I don't know. I think not too many people who are bankrupt, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, they're not going to turn. Are they going to turn into a photo op? I suspect not.
You know, I suspect that not. I'm trying to think what his schedule is for today. I have not seen anything on the schedule about that being a photo op.
So he's just going to quietly do it. I think it's become radioactive. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, thanks so much for being with us today, Victoria.
Thank you.
Have a great one. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
Now for a traffic update, we go to Kelly Clark. Kelly, how's it looking out there?
Well, if you've got to get anywhere, I hope you have lots of time.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Turn on the light. Turn on the light.
And that's not John Bolton's song. Turn on the light, what? No. Welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the top of the hour. Or 33 minutes past the hour, you could say, if you're going to do digital time. Welcome back. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Liz in Pennsylvania is on the line. Hey, Liz, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. If you can put up with my croaking, I have two quick legal points to make.
Okay.
The first is that conservatives like Clarence Thomas are very fond of directing you to Section 2, Article 1 of the Constitution in support of the idea that states can pull electors out of a hat. But they don't want you to look at the 14th Amendment, Section 2, which says if they do that, they lose not only representatives, but electors, because the basis of representation is reduced proportionate
right.
for people who have been disenfranchised.
For the Electoral College, for,
exactly.
for president, yeah.
But also for representatives to the Congress, because
right.
that's the basis of the number of electors you get, part of
right.
the basis.
Right, part of it's a combination of the House and the Senate, isn't it?
Right, yeah. exactly. Yeah. So that's a fairly draconian penalty, and I don't know of any remedies that don't have rights standing behind them. The second point I wanted to make, you had a caller this morning that I just caught saying that Darlene Gilhooly was claiming that judges under the new bankruptcy bill will be able to do individual justice in cases of, you know, extreme duress or whatever. And that's exactly what the new bankruptcy bill prevents. It strips discretion out of Article III courts. It strips discretion from judges. Right now, if a judge looks at your case, he can take the totality of your circumstances into account. But the means test replaces that. Basically, you could replace the judge with a computer or an accountant or anybody who could fill out a form.
This is like the equivalent of minimum mandatory sentencing.
Exactly. It's that, and several of the bills that have come before the Congress recently, including the class action litigation reform, do exactly that. They either strip the court of discretion or they strip the court of jurisdiction. And since the courts are where we do individual justice,
right.
You know, the legislature can't do individual justice. It makes rules for everybody. But a court is where, you know, the particulars of your case or controversy are heard, and where justices are supposed to fashion remedies. That's what justice is. It's the application of general law to particular fact in
right.
a fair manner.
Right.
So this bankruptcy law actually works against that, and it works against individual justice generally.
Yeah, it, broadly, specifically.
Well,
at every level.
Let me give you a particular.
Yeah.
If you have a child who becomes ill with cancer and you have to quit your job to take care of the child and you have lots of bills coming up, there is no exemption to the means testing. So the judge can't say, well, yes, you have a certain amount of money in the bank, but I can see that your salary is now going to stop, and I can see that you're going to have some big bills coming up, and I can see that you're going to need this money. So I will tailor a remedy to your situation.
Right.
No more tailoring.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just you have
gone.
The money
and
in the bank, pay up.
And in fact, there had been an amendment offered to that bill when it was in the Senate
mm-hmm.
to allow for exemptions for people who had to care for a sick relative.
Precisely.
And that was voted down with 100% of the Senate Republicans voting against it, as well as three Senate Democrats.
And all of the particulars that were offered as amendments, the judge will not be able to remedy.
Yeah, and whereas the judge can remedy under the law as it stands until George W. Bush has signed it, which may be already today. Today he's signing the bill.
That's right.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. Well, Liz, thank you for the primer, or the primer. I appreciate it, the info, and thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Okay. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 1-866-889-8894. Harriet in Seattle is on the line. Hey, Harriet.
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to let you know, among other things, there are a couple of Costcos in Portland, so you have to get out and get your government ID card pretty quick.
Are there? Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll do it. My official government ID card from Costco.
You got it.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. The other thing is this issue up here in Washington. Apparently, Maria Cantwell, Democratic senator, is on the radar screen for the White House.
Yes.
And
which radar screen? The build them up or the shoot them down?
The get rid of her.
Yeah, the shoot them down. Okay.
Yep. And the White House apparently is working with three potential candidates, and they're looking at saying there will be no Republican primary in the state of Washington, that they're going to make the decision. And this really, really scares the heck out of me.
This is similar to what we had a caller an hour or so ago, maybe an hour and a half ago, talking about something like this going on in Pennsylvania, where
right.
elected officials are being replaced by appointed officials. It's
yep.
it's a different specific, but the broad same principle. Let's let the party do the business behind closed doors in smoke-filled rooms.
Well, this is it. I mean, there are three that are sort of in the running, although they're saying Dino Rossi, should he fail with the governor, is going to be the first on the list.
Right.
And the other three, a couple of them have already been to Washington, and it's saying, this is the part that scares me, because two of these guys have said the White House has expressed its interest in a primary free election against Cantwell.
And the reason why, of course, is because primaries wound candidates.
Right.
They burn through their cash, and they also, if there's negative advertising involved, the electorate is left with the negative points, and they remember those.
So. Well, they're also saying neither the vice president or the president will come out here because they don't want the primary to be messy. Well, they're just saying they won't hold one. I mean, isn't there something about the electorate having a right to a free election?
Not in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Let's just be upfront about this. It's not in the Republican Party.
It's not in the Republican Party.
And I'm surprised that the Republicans are not concerned about this. But I think that so many Republicans have been getting into this kind of get along, go along, whatever they say, that's what we'll do. We're part of the crowd. You know, the following geese.
By
the way, thank you for your incredible goose story about backing down a goose and grabbing its beak and staring it in the eyes and. After it tried to attack you, and then when you walked around, it followed you.
It followed me and protected me. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
That's a great story. That was just a great story. Thanks for sharing that in email with me.
Anytime.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the same thing with Lugar yesterday at this meeting that they were having, kind of looking there almost with a dumb expression on his face saying, well, Bush wants Bolton, so we have to go along with it.
Yeah.
I don't comprehend that.
Yeah, well, it's called party loyalty, and it happens in the Democratic Party as well. In that regard, William Green was right. It does, this sort of thing, these sorts of things do happen in both parties. However, it seems to be just the meal of the day in the Republican Party. It's
There's no sense to it, and the people aren't standing up saying, wait a minute, this isn't right.
Yeah, it's Tammany Hall, you know, for what it's worth, all over again. Harriet, thanks for the call. Thanks for bringing these issues up. I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Always good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Tom in Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great. I understand you have a story to tell us.
Oh, yeah. You know, a couple of weeks ago when I called in and told you and Bernie what I do to become active, and I work out of my house, and I monitor NPR often and some of these right-wing crank shows, and just now, this guy out of L.A., Dennis Prager, do you know that show?
Yes, I do. In fact, on at least two of the stations that this show is carried on, they took him off and put us on, so yeah.
Oh, great.
That's how I know of him.
All right. Well, you know, I used to live in California, and I used to listen to him, and he's become really, you know, extreme fundamentalist.
He started out, you know, as essentially a preacher. I mean,
is that right? Okay.
Yeah, Salem Broadcasting is a Christian. Started out as a Christian broadcasting network, and he's syndicated by Salem, and many, if not most, of their hosts have their roots in fundamentalist evangelism.
That explains it then. Sure. And so today he was talking about Bolton and the UN and saying how the Democrats and liberals, they never can recognize evil. They're gutless. The gutless hate the courageous and all this stuff, right? So I called up and I said, you know, Dennis, I've listened to you for many years, and you always say we liberals. I told him I used to be conservative, I thought, but I became very liberal when I lived in Europe and saw that they have true democracy. And I said, you know, you keep saying we can't recognize evil, and I look back, Clinton, he defeated Milosevic, Kennedy, Johnson, they beat the went after the communists in Vietnam, Truman, Korea, FDR, the right-wing fascists. What do you mean we don't recognize evil? He says, oh, well, I used to be a liberal until Clinton, you know, and the culture wars.
Yeah, right.
Right? And then I said, you always call Europe socialist. You imply that they're not elected and not free. And he goes, I've never said that. I go, yeah, you imply with the word socialism that they're not, you know, free democracies. And then he says, well, I said, you know, you Republicans always conflate, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, right. Well, we're not a democracy. We're a republic, just like you said they'll do.
Yeah.
And I said, no, that's semantics. That just means representative democracy. Let's don't go down that road. And then he kind of like,
yeah.
You know, I just said, you know.
Talking point 27. Quick, where's the book?
Hey, by the way, that's
good on you,
book?
Tom. Good on you.
I love your book, We the People. I have a lot of great quotes in there. I put little, use it as a talking points book.
Uh-huh, good. Okay, so now I'm the source of the talking points.
But that's how we get active, man.
I agree.
NPR and be on the lookout for all these right-wing guests and even the hosts, because the hosts are weak.
Yeah.
They don't ask the right questions.
No, they don't. And they're not interested in digging deeper, and they're not interested in having on the opposition. It's what's really surprising to me, and this is it really took me aback when I got into this back into this business. I mean, I had been in radio for years, but I'd never been in talk radio until about 3 years ago when I started this program, first in Vermont, and then we went on IE America Radio Network, and you know, now we're independent. And the assumption that I had been operating under was based on what the conservatives had been saying on the radio, that I'd heard all these talk show hosts say for years and years and years, was that everybody was listening to them, both liberals and conservatives, number one, and number two, that only the conservatives wanted to call them, and number three, that the liberals didn't want to talk to them, didn't want to be on their programs, and that, you know, therefore there's something wrong with liberty. And when I started the program, I invite conservatives to come on this program. We try to get, literally, seriously, no exaggeration, we try to get every single day a conservative to come on this program, and maybe once every week or two now we can get them on. I mean, even the folks from Ayn Rand, who had been really good about coming on the program, and I thought I'd been treating them fairly decently, they're not willing to come on the program anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's not like I beat them up or call them names. It's like you out these folks enough times, and they're like, okay, that's it, no more. And I'm running out of conservative guests. Heritage Foundation won't send me people anymore. We call their PR people. I know them. I've spoken there. They're decent people, you know. I mean, the individual humans. But, you know, they call up the cons and say, hey, will you come on the liberal program? Nope, won't do it.
Right. What I've learned from you is how you stay focused on we the people, democracy.
Yeah.
They do not like democracy.
No, not at all. Democracy, no, they're interested in free market capitalism, which is most politically connected to feudalism.
If you keep that in focus like you do, and I tend to do, they hate it. They run like you say. They won't come on when you just keep hanging on. I want to talk about democracy because you believe in democracy, don't you? Yeah, I do, in words only, right?
Yeah.
And you start telling them what it is, they know that their philosophy doesn't conform with what democracy is all about.
Yeah. Well done, Tom. Yeah. Keep up the good work.
Everybody else, just, you know, monitor NPR, man.
Yeah, there you go. And whatever else is available to you, but... You know, listen to the show when it's on the air, too.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Tom. Yeah. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. Always good to hear from you. One of our great activists. I am so impressed, frankly. I have to just say, humbled and impressed by the level of activism and the quality of activism that I'm seeing and hearing emerge and sensing emerge within the progressive community over the last year and a half, 2 years. I was not seeing this 2 years ago when I first started doing this program, or 2.5 years ago, a little more than 2 years ago. And it is growing. And that, to me, is a really, really, really good sign. It's a really good sign for democracy in the United States, for democracy in our democratic republic. It's really a good sign for the future, for our children and their children. It's a good sign for this world. And I want to encourage more of it. Please get out there and get active. Here, and here you'll see the consequences of this. President Bush doesn't fare very well. This from CBSNews.com. Doesn't fare very well in the latest CBS News poll with an approval rating of just 44%. Congress only got 35%, a 35% approval rating. In fact, disapproval of the Republican-controlled Congress even extends to 39% of Republicans. 4 out of 10 Republicans say they disapprove of Congress, which is, as you know, Republican-controlled. Only 37% think that the current Congress has accomplished so far anything good for the country. 41% think what the Congress has done has been bad for the country. So a majority of people, not an absolute majority, but if you compare these two statistics, more people, how do you say this, more people think what Congress has done has been bad for the United States than think what Congress has done has been good for the United States. Now, why would that be? Why would it be that Congress would only have a 35% approval rating, Bush would only have a 44% approval rating, and only 37% of people would think that Congress is doing good, 41% would think that Congress is doing evil or bad? Could it be because they really don't have a mandate, that the cons who have taken over this, over our method of government, our means of government, who have taken over the House, the Senate, the White House, the Supreme Court, that the cons who have infiltrated their way into all these different dimensions of our lives, that these cons really have no interest in democracy, they have no interest in seeing this republic really blossom and flourish and be the kind of nation it can be, And instead, their primary interest is partisan politics and making sure that their corporate sponsors are well represented. That the aristocracy, the plutocracy, the 7,000 households in America that earn more than $10 million a year, 7,000 households in America that earn more than $10 million a year, that their interests are well and solidly represented, whereas the interests of everybody else, well, they'll also look out for the interests of those who earn between $1 million and $10 million a year. I'm not sure how many more households that is, but the at the very top, that's where the real political power is being concentrated in this country, and it is a concern that we all should have. It's the reason why the Senate has sitting before it now this legislation to end the estate tax. And one of the reasons why you should be calling 1-877-SOB-USOB and asking for your senator and saying, you know, support the estate tax, don't kill it off. 10 minutes before the hour. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. With the continuing erosion of the middle class and the separation between the rich and poor increasing at an alarming rate as America...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. I'm Tom Hartman with you here at 54 minutes after the hour, whichever hour it may be, wherever you are on planet Earth. A senior partner. Actually, we have theme music for this, don't we? Let's see if we can make it. Here we go. There we go. A senior partner in Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's shaky coalition threatened to quit on Tuesday, a move which could bring down his government, lead to a snap general election. Our Berlusconi alert music, O Solo Milo. Berlusconi has been in crisis since the much smaller Union of Christian Democrats, UDC, quit his government on Friday. Then this from the news this morning. Italy's Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi will resign on Wednesday. That's today. The ANSA news agency quoted his party top lawmaker in the Senate as saying, and the folks in the chat room are telling me, he did it. He has resigned. Well, he told me that a couple days ago, and he hadn't. So, but I'll believe you this time. The news agency said Renato Schifani told a meeting of Forza Italia senators, the 68-year-old prime minister, would tender his resignation to State President Carlo Angelo Chiampi after addressing the Senate in the crisis enveloping his government. There have been growing expectations that Berlusconi would resign as a preamble to forming a new government to comply with the demands of his partners in the civil center-right coalition. You'll recall Berlusconi is the guy who was a small-time crook and small businessman who bought a newspaper and then bought a radio station and then bought a TV station and then bought another radio station and then another TV station and then another radio station. Pretty soon he owned all the radio stations, then he owned all the TV stations, then he owned all the newspapers. When he owned 90% of the media in Italy, he ran for political office, and guess what? He won! Yeah. And even that couldn't protect him from being an incompetent right-wing buddy of George W. Bush. So, Silvio Berlusconi, well, his resignation doesn't mean he's gone. It means he may actually come back stronger. We'll see. But, Silvio, we wish you to go away, actually. We shall see. We shall see. Oh, solo mio. Oh, what a beautiful voice. That's not Berlusconi. That is merely our new Berlusconi alert music. By the way, last tip for the day, Jim Jeffords, the senator from Vermont, the independent senator from Vermont, the only member of the Senate, who is not affiliated with the Democrats or Republicans, he left the Republican Party, the only Republican I've ever voted for in my life, says that he is going to resign from the Senate, or he's not going to resign. He's not going to run for re-election in 2006. Bernie Sanders, in the media, is saying, well, you know, we'll see. On this program, he said he will run for Jefford's seat. So I'm taking him at his word on that. So that should be an interesting story. We'll ask him about that on Friday. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Louise for all her help in producing the program. We will see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
This is Vivil Nik Raskin. I'm the president and founder of the Organic Wine Company.